Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Daniela Scioni, a comedian, screenwriter, and script supervisor on projects like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, The Boondock Saints, Suits, and the first season of People of Earth. She's also the creator, producer, and host of Toronto's West End Girls stand-up show. She's also an old friend. We've known each other, 30 years now since film school, which makes it perfect that she should choose Gross Point Blank, the delightful satirical 1997 action comedy that gave John Cusack the role of his career. Look, it's my show. I get to make those declarations. Cusack played Martin Blank, an elite international assassin assigned to carry out a hit in his Michigan hometown on the weekend of his 10th high school reunion. Set on a collision course with his past and undergoing a bit of an existential crisis, Martin will be forced to reckon with his moral choices, his place in the world, and Debbie Newberry, the girl he left behind. Also, murder. You know how it is. This is someone else's movie.
Well, I'm a comedy writer, and I aspire to be a great dialogue writer. I think that's going to be my forte. If people have written about that, about my work, which is great. But Gross Point Blank is, to me, one of the great examples of comedy writing, especially in dialogue. It's really smart. It's really funny. It's a high concept as well. It just is a classic, you know, and it combines two genres that at the time, I had certainly never seen the combination of romantic comedy and action before. Yeah. That alone is clever. But, you know, I had read early out, just when you asked me to do this, I read early reviews of it and they weren't great. Like,
yeah, it was. Well, when did you first see it? Would you have seen it?
Oh, I saw it in the theater. I don't exactly remember who I was with, probably my best friend, but we loved it. I just remember loving it, and it just had everything I needed at the time. Of course, it speaks directly to me because he's going to his class of 86 reunion. I mean, we're exactly that age. Of course, the music and everything, it's exact, you know.
Yeah.
You could not find a more appropriate audience member than me. Even though it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, when you look back on it,
no,
it really does not. But I didn't care because the women had so many, and I didn't know about it at the time I saw it, of course. But the women had all kinds of interesting things to do in the movie as well, but even though.
Yeah, it's weird, right? I mean, it is, in a lot of ways, I've been arguing for Shaun of the Dead as the original mashup film.
Oh, yeah.
But I think, and then to do that, I also have to say, but there's also Galaxy Quest.
Oh, yeah.
which predates Shaun by 5 years. Yeah, Gross Point Blank was 2 years before Galaxy Quest, and it is the... It's a play on 80s romantic comedies because of the presence of John Cusack, obviously, right away. And then also, weirdly, you have the John Woo scale violence that kind of pushes into everything.
Well, I watched it again for this, and I was like, oh my God, this is a John Hughes film with rage. It is... Yeah. It has all the elements, right? It's got the casting of a John Hughes movie. It's got the soundtrack. It's got the shooting style. It's got, you know, the structure. It's got the... are the boy and girl going to get together? You know, so it's like how, you know, I actually had a theory at one point. I thought, I wonder, because I think at that point, John Hughes had quit the business in a, you know, not in rage, but in a, like, he was just tired of Hollywood and he just wanted, and I had this feeling at the back of my head that he must have been somehow involved, because this screenwriter who first pitched the idea, like he was an unknown, and he still didn't do anything after. And then he did, according to his obituary, which I just found out he died. Timothy Yankowitz, he made a living rewriting other people's scripts, which you can make a great living at, of course. But he never, and he had other things optioned according to his family. But I thought, at first I thought, is this a fake bio? Is this a fake obit?
No, did you think it's just they created the character so Cusack wouldn't have to take credit for it? I was really surprised. I found out that this script had been kicking around for a while.
Since 1991.
Which would make even more sense because John Hughes was active then, but he'd stopped making high school movies and he'd started making the weird stuff like Curly Sue and Uncle Buck, you know, films that are fondly remembered by people who were really young when they first saw them. But he stopped with the social commentary, he abandoned all that stuff and just started making dumb movies, and then someone else sort of picked up the torch in a weird way with this. And I really surprisingly found out that Kiefer Sutherland
yeah.
was going to be Martin Blank, yeah. was attached to it in 93.
Yes, that's right.
And I mean, yeah, I could see it. I sort of could, like right after Flatliners, that Kiefer Sutherland could do it. But what a radically different film it would have been. And also because Cusack and his guys, like Steve Pink,
yes.
and would not have rewritten the script into what it is.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. That's yeah. true, right? I mean, yeah, you look at their stamp in the future and High Fidelity and Hot Tub Time Machine, which I've never seen Hot Tub Time Machine, but yeah, but they obviously true. Had, you know, continued on a rep. But I had, and also the fact that it was set in Grosse Pointe and Detroit, and, you know, and John Hughes being from that area, I just was convinced that somehow he was secretly...
pulling the strings.
Yeah, but you know, we were also influenced by that era, that it's quite possible that it, you know, I had this, I guess it was a secret fantasy that he kept writing. But did you read how the writer Tim Yankowitz died?
No.
He was asked at the he was living in Santa Barbara and he was near one of the USC campuses, and the professor said, "Hey, can you come talk to my class tonight about Grosse Pointe Blank?" And he had a heart attack. He presented the film and had a heart attack right there. And I was like, okay.
At the screening.
At the screening. Oh, he spoke about it. It was during the Q&A. And he died. And he was like in his 50s or something. He was not old. So, yeah. So, is that a fake obit?
That's the kind of thing there's going to be witnesses.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, exactly.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
And what a legacy to leave, too. Just like yeah. this really idiosyncratic movie that no one remembers you for because everyone just sees John Cusack.
Yeah.
Like, it's the... I do think, even in a world that gives us Say Anything in High Fidelity, I do think it's the perfect... I think it's the ultimate of Cusack's career. It's just... Yeah. It incorporates everything he's always talked about. You know, politics, corporate manipulation, subterfuge, meddling... And also has this whole broken heart thing that just, like, at the time, I remember my friends and I were talking about it as though it was, like, a stealth Say Anything sequel. Because he could simply have been, like, this could be Lloyd Dobler. He would have a different name. Of course he would. Except that when he gets back, everybody calls him Martin. But the continuity of that, like, the sense that this and Say Anything in High Fidelity are this weird trilogy of yeah. you know, like, John Cusack as the broken... heartthrob that everybody needs to fix.
And I think actually Grosse Pointe Blank was the first film his company did, right? It was the first film yeah. he produced. So he had such a deep hand in it. I mean, this...
Oh, there's Tape Heads, though.
Oh, he produced Tape Heads. Yeah, I love that movie.
Nobody remembers.
I love that movie.
It's so great. I'm doing a quiet campaign with Shout Factory to pick it up and do a special edition on Blu-ray because it is like, if you... Listeners, if you haven't seen Tape Heads, Tape Heads is the goddamn best.
Yeah.
It makes no sense in the present day. Like, it's insane. It's a movie in which two guys who were in theaters together, and stage friends, John Cusack and Tim Robbins, get together and make a silly movie that is a tribute to Motown soul, essentially, and is just the best.
I saw that at the Blur Cinema around the time it came out. Oh, my God. I loved it so much.
That's when I saw it, too. It is like nothing else. I think I still have the Laserdisc, actually.
I'm still a huge fan. I know he didn't produce it, but I'm still a huge fan of John Cusack in Better Off Dead. I thought Better Off Dead had that quirk. I just like the quirk of it all.
Like, yeah. He's had a really interesting... I mean, of course he's had a really interesting career. That's yeah. a dumb thing to say. But his early career, like the first movement of his career, is fascinating because he is this really serious theater kid
yeah.
who... did all of this bizarre experimental stuff that doesn't look bizarre and experimental until you see it in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
Because right? in the 80s, everything was stylistically, you could do whatever you wanted and you could be silly or you could be serious. And somehow, like right off the bat with The Sure Thing and Better Off Dead, he established that he was capable of like literally anything.
Yeah.
Within a genre or not, he could just do stuff.
His intellect, I mean, I am intellectually attracted. I mean, he's an attractive guy, but I am intellectually attracted to him. He is so smart, and that really shines through in Grosse Pointe Blank.
Yeah.
In my comedy writing class, I always show the clip when he's with Dan Aykroyd in the ordering omelets, ordering breakfast.
Right.
Fuck, Some of, like, if people haven't seen the movie, my students have a hard time even following what they're saying. They're so super clever. Yeah. It's just, I'm just laughing my head off all the way through it. They never pick the obvious anything. Never the obvious word. Never the obvious way the scene could go. There's always a surprise, you know? I mean, they get together in the end, which is the, you have to do in a romantic comedy, and it's very satisfying, obviously. But other than that, there's nothing that you really expect.
Yeah, it crackles in a way that mm-hmm. a lot of other movies don't, action movies and comedies don't. And I think part of it, there's two things that really stood out to me on last viewing, which is that everyone in it is a comedian.
Yeah.
Every single, like Hank Azaria.
Yeah.
as an NSA stooge is still playing a comic role. Like everybody in it is kind of pulling the same rope. They're on the same page and they have the same energy. Which is something that Soderbergh mentioned when he cast The Informant, with like everyone in it is a comedian. Paul Tompkins shows up in it as a, but they're playing straight roles. And he said he just wanted to do that to see what happened, to see the comic energy and then infect a serious movie, which then turns out to be not so serious at all because it's fun. But part of it is the fact that he has cast people who are going to give him the wrong line reading or the unpredictable angle, no matter what.
Oh, there's nothing I love more than working with a full cast of comedians. Like I worked on the Boondock Saints and there were so many comics in that. And it's again, like, I mean, whatever you think of the Boondock Saints, it is ultimately funny. And I guess partly intentionally, yeah. But yeah, that and Willem of course
Dafoe doesn't get enough credit for that one.
Oh, he's so funny. He's so funny.
He found the top and he kept going. but I interrupted you.
Oh no, it's okay. And People of Earth, which is a comedic show, so they hire up. But it's just such a night and day working experience. So I could, you know, and that's the thing. I worked with Dan Aykroyd, but not in a comedic role. I worked on Sci Factor season 1.
Okay.
And he's extremely. He's got this crazy intellect, like so smart. He would just come in and do, you know, the intros and out, I guess it was just the intros to every episode. We'd shoot him on a day or two. He'd remember everyone's name. He'd leave for months and then come back and do some more. Super sharp, super smart, very, very, very serious and very into the paranormal.
Oh, yeah.
Little did I know he was going from our show to go work on Gross Point Blank. I would have begged to follow him and be on set, but.
And his character, the story there, you know, like he wanted to play it with an Eastern European accent, like he was kind of an ex-KGB or
I can't Mr. believe Block that. Guy.
And it wouldn't have, like, it would have killed him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's so good as a normal person.
Oh, yeah, as him, it really read like himself.
Yeah.
You know, like he had a, him and his brother had a lot of interesting theories about everything, like conspiracy wise. I mean, I only heard, he didn't say it directly, but everyone on the crew's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But you can see that there was so much of him in that character. So smart, so funny, so much rage in a way. But, yeah. What did I want
to? He's eminently reasonable. That was the other thing I wanted to. You know, like, everybody's a comic, but everybody has a point of view that makes sense.
Yeah.
And they're all monsters. Like, well, not all of them, but you know, Minnie Driver's okay. Everybody else is working this agenda and absolutely blind to the moral implications. The whole point of it is, you know, what happens in a John Woo movie when someone wakes up and realizes that he's doing bad things.
Oh yeah, as I rewatched it, I noticed all the, because when I first saw it, I wasn't a writer yet. I didn't know anything about structure and like planting, you know, the theme all over the place. And there's so many theme statements all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, about second chances. There's a few lines about second chances. It's life is full of second chances. And Aykroyd says it like right in the first scene where we meet him, when he pulls up and says, let's join a union. Yeah. And then Minnie Driver says that at one point. But I was like, oh, this is... And then I had read this review that criticized it for being sloppy. And I thought, this person doesn't understand because the structurally it's perfect. He doesn't meet Minnie Driver. He doesn't see her until 30 minutes in. And she doesn't see him kill the guy and take off until 30 minutes before the end. That is like dead on perfect structure. Right. And what else? Oh, so Ebert loved the movie but hated the ending. He thought there was too much gun violence. I reread his review.
Well, that's sort of the point.
Exactly. Right. Like you can't do the two. You have to follow the tropes of the genres, even if you're mixing the genres. And that's what made it so hilarious.
Yeah. And the invention of the action. The fact that it is clever violence that there's the elaborate traps, which are just so much fun, with the spoofs on Bond and just sort of that sense that the action is meticulously, insanely planned out to a degree that it couldn't possibly work in the real world. But of course, that's how you know we're in an action movie. That self-awareness is just delightful. But there's also the invention that Cusack is allowed to show that no one else is, which is why he's the best. This is the John Wick argument, right? The reason that he shoots everybody in the head is so they won't bother him again later. And then gradually throughout the two movies, you realize there are just enough people that he's left alive that you understand that, oh, okay, someone left him alive once too, and this is why he's now A, the best, and B, merciless.
Did you read that he was a kickboxer in real life?
Cusack.
Yes.
Yes. Well, his assassin friend, the Harvey Keitel lookalike, is actually his trainer, right? Like his kickboxer coach.
Yeah. And,
but he was kickboxing back in Say Anything, too. Like, yeah. That's a thing that he's always been.
Oh, yeah. Because that's his other passion. And because as I was rewatching it, I had just shot XXX last, and I was like, oh my God, this fight, the one where they take each other down in the high school hallway rivals any fight scene in XXX. And yes. Honestly, like,
no, it's great.
It's like, there's no body doubles here. These are these two guys fighting it, and it's very well choreographed. And then I read about his kickboxing. Yeah. So,
and Cusack is huge too. Like, he's really tall.
6'3". That's hot.
I thought he was taller.
What they claim.
I met him in a hallway at the Dear Departed Sutton Place during TIFF 1 year, and we did the Swanky Moans dance. He came out of an elevator. I was in the hallway. I said, oh, hey, how are you? And we'd never met before. He was there for something at TIFF. I don't even remember what year it was. I'm sure I can find this out. But I just, like I said, all I want to do is tell you how much I love tape. And he just said, Swanky Moans. We did a couple of steps. I'm like, yeah, all right, fine. I'm in your corner forever. And I'm sure he does that every day with people. Maybe he did at the time. But it was just... Martin Blank is pretty much who he is, I think, with the addition of being an elite assassin. But I don't think he's acting so much as just channeling. I think that's it's a really, and he gets no credit for this incredibly naturalistic performance in the middle of this action movie where people are blowing each other's faces off. But he is just so good and so immediate in every scene.
The baby scene.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you can have him just be still and stuff comes out.
I just read something actually today that Pauline Kael called him the man with the question marks in his eyes.
Aww.
Which is so perfect, right? And I don't know, I was trying to find when she said that, and I couldn't find, because I was like, is she talking about Gross Point Blank, or is she talking about earlier?
It must have been earlier.
Earlier, right?
I mean, she retired around the early 90s.
Oh, yeah. So, wow. Like, how appropriate that quote is to Gross Point Blank, that is.
Yeah.
As he's, like, shooting someone and, oh, my God. It's so... Oh, and now, I don't know. I read also that, and I didn't know this, but, of course, he and Minnie Driver dated. I don't know if it was before or after the movie.
One assumes after, just because of how movies work.
So electric. So electric.
But it's weird. Yeah, it's funny. I generally, when there's chemistry between a pair of actors on screen, there isn't a relationship, right? Like
yes.
A handful of exceptions, but for the most part,
absolutely, it doesn't work out.
Yeah, sure. That's what acting is. But there is something, like, there's a, I don't know how to put it exactly, but there's like an intellectual echo going on there, like,
yes,
between the two,
yeah,
of them in the movie. Her timing is so good and so perfectly hostile. Like, she is not going to let him off the hook for the things that he did.
I love when she slaps him in the face when she's about to, you know, they're about to go in the nurse's station. She goes, wait, something's missing. Slaps him. I don't know. I related to that somehow. But also, and also Joan Cusack, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, between Dan Aykroyd and Minnie and Joan, and like, these are really, really smart, smart people. And they bring it all to the screen.
It's always a surprise every time I watch it to realize that Joan Cusack is practically isolated from, or literally, yeah, isolated. She only interacts with him.
Yeah.
And has no other, and Arkin too. Like, Arkin doesn't even, well, he talks to his other patient at one point.
Yeah, she's cowering in the background, yeah, or something. But, yeah.
But it is this amazing kind of compartmentalized story where we follow Martin as he goes from thing to thing to thing and leaves every time, he, with the exception of Joan Cusack, he leaves chaos behind him and psychological, if not physical, destruction.
Well, I mean, he does leave it. She has to burn down the whole office, right? But
that's,
he leaves
true,
her money.
Ultimately,
right?
Yeah. But he looks out for her.
Yeah. Oh, she. The film could have passed the Bechdel test in that one scene. I realized, because they have her talking to a woman when she's talking about the recipe and then yelling at the supplier for delivering. But it's just that we never cut to the woman she's talking to. She identifies her as a woman. That would have, but then, you know, then it would have killed the joke.
Yeah, it's true. You can't have her with somebody else. Oh, there's just so much right about it. And again, the tone on something like this is amazing, not just because it is perfect from start to finish. It has this amazing musical drive that carries through.
Yeah.
And that goes to the score, that goes to Cusack again in the soundtrack, because he had to know what he wanted. And as a producer, I'm sure he leaned very heavily on the Joe Strummer stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But also, there wasn't... We were talking about this. There wasn't a movie like this before. There wasn't a tone like this. Pulp Fiction comes close.
Yeah.
Because it's playful and involved in the lives of its characters and also incredibly violent. But it doesn't have the... how can I put it? It doesn't have the joy that Grosse Pointe has. Like, the last moments of Pulp Fiction are really, really cool. When you walk out with the Men in Black from... Brother from Another Planet reference, and you just go out on a high, and that's amazing, and that's Tarantino for you. And then somehow, 3 years later, Armitage figures out a way to make that high last for the whole 100 minutes.
And I always wonder how much of that is because of how old we are. We are the right age for this.
Yes.
But Armitage was not. He's like my mother's age.
Yeah.
So how did he do it? I mean, he's just got to be some kind of genius. He only did one more film after this, and he only did very few films.
And it's a mess. Yeah, The Big Bounce.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it's a remake. It's the movie that every time I watch Grosse Pointe Blank, I want to look at The Big Bounce again. And then twice now I have, and I'm like, no.
No.
It's not good. It was part of the Elmore Leonard wave. The post-Soderbergh Leonard wave, and it is not good.
But did you know, I looked it up because I was like, who is this man?
Miami Blues, on the other hand.
Oh, was it great?
You haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Miami Blues is produced by Jonathan Demme, directed by Armitage, based on a Charles Wolliford novel. It is, still Alec Baldwin's greatest role. Jennifer Jason Leigh is fantastic in it. Fred Ward is amazing.
Oh.
It's, dead perfect. Brightly colored, sun-drenched Florida noir. And it's amazing. Again, walking a perfect line between self-aware commentary on the genre and... straight up genre story. Really unpleasant violence, really funny relationship stuff, but with much more menace. You're not supposed to like Baldwin's character. He's a pure sociopath.
Wow. So does he always direct movies about sociopaths?
He seems good at it. He definitely works in the crime genre. It really is fantastic, and it's one of those movies where I think I have managed to will it into existence on Blu-ray, just because I know the guys at Shout Factory, and I sent them an email as soon as I heard they'd acquired this catalog package, and Tom Chen has never confirmed or denied this, but I'm pretty sure that my all caps email, oh my God, you have to put Miami Blues out, I have willed that into existence. But yeah, no, anybody listening to this, George Armitage is a guy that you should really know more about. And yeah, he didn't work very much. He worked regularly every 5 years. He would put something out. There's 6 years between Miami Blues and Grosse Pointe Blank.
Did you know that he came out of the Corman, the Roger Corman? Okay, I have to tell you, some of the best directors I've worked with in television came out of that whole era. Like, people you've never heard of. Like, I haven't heard of George. I mean, I know you have, but there's so many directors that I had never heard of, and I thought, okay, who is this guy? On People of Earth, I was so excited because Greg Daniels was going to be directing.
Right.
And he's a comic genius, and I was so excited. But before that, I had to do two episodes with some guy named Rodman Flenders.
Oh, I know Flenders stuff, yeah.
And, I mean, Idle Hands,
you made Idle Hands, exactly.
And I thought, okay, great. And I told Rodman, I'm like, I have no idea who you are. It was so funny. And then we laughed about it after because he's... a fucking great, he's a great director of television and I'm sure of film, but he said, he told me the whole story. Corman made us great. And so
I believe it.
You
have to, Demme as well. Demme worked for Corman and all those guys in the 70s. There's story upon story upon story of people learning how to do just really interesting or entertaining stuff with no resources and no time. Like, James Cameron making something on Battle Beyond the Stars out of egg cartons that he then spray painted with silver to make it look like a space hallway. He just did the whole wall with it. It was a trick he stole from an acoustic sound booth.
Oh my God.
Or Joe Dante on Piranha. just trying to find ways for things to happen and then finally being told that you have 10 minutes in a puppet. But, and it still works somehow because you have this glee of being able to do it at all.
Oh, that's the thing. You get the sense that everyone that worked with him was already like excited about filmmaking anyway. It's like it was a joy farm or something. It was like,
I wonder if that's it. Like you get to, you know, you make your pitch and you get to say like, you know, Mr. Corman, I'll do anything to work with you. And then you find out that that's pretty much how it has to work.
Yeah.
You'll get no money and you'll get a credit if you're lucky. And
he would say, okay, then you're going to assistant direct or you're going to script supervise and then you're going to direct in two more movies. You know, that's how you would get his main crew.
It's like an apprentice system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dante cut trailers with Alan Arkush for 2 years, I think. And then they made Hollywood Boulevard, which is made about trailers. That's how it works. It's kind of incredible. And I don't think there's anything like it now. I mean, you could kind of have Joe Swanberg's Indie Factory or you know, Alex Gibney's Documentary Machines, where he cranks out 3 films a year and all of those people working on them will go off and make their own stuff. But yeah, I guess it's just a different market entirely, right? Because there's no more exploitation circuit. There's no more two.
We used to have a thing in Toronto called Power Pictures. I never worked with Power Picture, but it was like a factory. They would churn out like 10 like low budget films a year, and everyone were. I think some of those directors went on to become Canada's TV directors, like really, because they just had so many hours. But after that was in the 80s and early 90s. After that, Toronto never really, because we just became a service provider for you know.
Yeah. Only now are we starting to see an identity for Toronto filmmakers, and they're all working with such small crews and small projects, $100,000 budgets, that there's just no way to build that up, I guess. You just work with the same people over and over again. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
But I mean, that's good.
It's self-restricting in a way.
Yeah, yeah. There's no, linchpin like Corman was, you know. There's no visionary at the helm saying, you know, and it would be nice if a body like Telephone could be the visionary that would say, okay, this is, but there's none of that, right?
They're not allowed to have vision.
They're not allowed to have
vision. I think that's sort of the inherent problem with Telephone, is that you have to maintain things so they can be the same next year. Like, so the funding can stay the same, so the distribution can stay the same. It's all, I don't know that anyone knows that at Telephone, but that's simply the way a bureaucracy forms, right? You just, you perpetuate what's already going on, and then you get trapped in perpetuating.
And we very rarely do high concept films in Canada. I think Good Cop, Bond Cop was one of the was high concept, and it was one of the only high grossing Canadian films. It's like, we don't.
Then we tried with Foolproof, and that was bad.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, okay. It's not. It's nobody's fault. It's just, it feels like the Super Channel version of a Hollywood movie.
That's bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's not Ryan Reynolds' fault. It's not Kristen Booth's fault. It's all, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do, but it just, it's got that, it still had that Canadian color timing. It had the look that says, we shot this and posted this in Ontario.
Oh, man.
And everybody knows what that is.
Hey, man, we shoot so many movies in Ontario. Oh, wow, and they look fantastic.
But that's digital grading.
Yeah, okay.
The one lab that processed everything, like, you can always tell in the early 90s, right?
Who the colorist was.
Yeah. Oh, that one came out of the NFB lab. You can always, you can spot this blue-green tint.
That's right.
It dominated Canadian cinema. Cronenberg's films didn't look like that, and the Goyans films didn't look like that because they made the effort.
Right, right.
But so many other films. I remember sitting down for something once at an NFB screening room. Oh, it was Paint Cans. It was Paul Donovan's films.
Right.
And
oh, yes.
This was this hugely anticipated adaptation of a daring novel. And within 2 minutes, it's like, is he making a commentary that all Canadian movies look the same? Or does this just look like every Canadian movie? And I never got an answer. And I guess it works either way. But it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, no, you're part of the problem. This isn't going to solve the
That reminded me of my friend worked on SCTV, and I made some comment about the makeup, and also in Made in Canada. Remember that show Made in Canada? I made some comment about how the makeup was so terrible, and my friend said, we did that on SCTV, and people would, but that was the joke. It's like, we're making something cheap.
Right. Yeah, you can turn it into an asset if you're clever about it. But then, to see that and not realize that. It's like, I mean, it would be like watching Gross Point Blank and wondering why he gets the girl.
Right. Right?
But he's killed a whole bunch of people. Does he really deserve to be happy? And that's why the ending is so great. It's because so it might not work because they...
I couldn't even imagine another ending. That's why, I mean, and Ebert wasn't the only one to say he hated the ending.
I still like, get it.
And this other guy, I mean, he had a blog, but he said that it looked like it was a post-production mess because they slapped together all these songs. And I was thinking, no. I can imagine Cusack does a mixtape for every single movie he produces and decides that first. And everything will be built around that. I would think it works the other way. And it was perfect.
Yeah, and the soundtrack for this film specifically, it informs everything.
And it's still one of the greatest soundtracks of all time.
I do love it.
Yeah.
That Matador song showed up in Desperado about 2 hours later. Maybe it wasn't Desperado. It was something else that year. Maybe it was Desperado. El Mariachi was 92. Desperado was earlier. But it wasn't the only time I'd heard that song before. But it's perfect.
Was it in Pulp Fiction, maybe? No, I don't know. No, but you know that Armitage and Tarantino were friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, of course Tarantino would love it. Miami Blues is really the pre-Tarantino movie. It's one that points you towards it, mm-hmm. I guess. Just the chatty villain thing, but married to a visual sensibility that's really gorgeous.
Yeah.
And, you know, that comes along, and then a year later we get Reservoir Dogs, and they married each other in my mind. They feel perfect together.
Oh, man. I have to see this movie.
Yeah, you do. It is magnificent. And I'm like, am I overselling it? No, I am not. Everyone go out and buy the Shout Factory Blu-ray of Miami Blues, because it's that good. Awesome. Yeah, and for years you couldn't even get like an anamorphic DVD of it. It was only available in this... MGM released it in this 4x3 widescreen. Ugh, it was awful. it finally returned 2 years ago and got the release that it deserved. And I will do anything to get... I'm kind of disappointed no one's picked Miami Blues yet. we'll get there. But no, it's so good. And it is... like, it is absolutely relevant to the discussion of Gross Point Blank, because it's the movie that shows you where this one came from, or maybe why Cusack needed Armitage to direct it, because it was a left field choice,
right?
You know, like the 10 of us who had loved Miami Blues were like, oh my god, it's a new Armitage movie, whatever it is. And I this is the other thing. I saw Gross Point Blank at a press screening or a public mm-hmm. preview, like the Wednesday before it opened.
Oh, okay.
And I remember it's one of a handful of films that I enjoyed far more the second time, because the first time I was on the edge of my seat praying that it didn't fuck up. The tone is so great, and the progression, it's so perfect that I'm like, they're going to blow the ending, or the second act isn't going to work. There's something is going to go wrong. This is too good. And then I came out of it on this incredible high and I loved it, and immediately dragged friend, because no one had come with me, and so I dragged my Mike was one of them. I dragged over. Like, I think I saw it 4 times theatrically. It was at the Hollywood. It was just down the street from me, so I just kept going and kept finding reasons to go. And also, I knew it wasn't going to last. So it's like, we should go right now. Let's go. Come on, Friday night, Saturday night. Let's go. And I think within 3 weeks, I saw it 4 times, including the preview.
Oh my god!
And each time it got better because I could enjoy the room. Like, the energy in the audience was so great.
And each time I watch it, I notice a new layer, like about whatever song is playing or about, oh, I finally get this reference that I didn't get before. There was a line that I just got on this last viewing. You're Detroit's biggest disappearing act since White Flight. Like, I never got that before. Yeah. I don't know. So clever. So just the word choices. The snap when Joan Cusack calls... a botched assassination attempt, a snafu. They're disappointed. Like, it's a snafu. It's like, as a writer, you can go through 10, 20, 30 different words before you go, that's the word.
Yeah.
And there's so much of that all over the script.
It is my favorite. She does have my favorite line in the entire movie, which is, it was as if everyone had swelled.
Oh my God. Did you go to your high school reunion?
I did not. I don't know that I ever, I'm not even sure I was aware of one. Oh, it's fine.
They avoided
they avoided me, probably. I didn't.
I just went to my 30th before you asked me on this podcast, so I wonder how much effect that had on my choice. But no, it's still a movie that sticks with me. But I had gone to my 15th high school reunion 5 years after that movie was made, and I kept thinking about that line and just laughing because it was true.
It's true.
It's true. You know, including myself, of course. But
all of us. But there's... And you see it a couple of times. It's never really hammered down in the movie because they're all still in their 20s and they look pretty good. But you've got, I can never remember the character's name. The drunk husband, the beefy ex-footballer who shows up and is basically incoherent.
Bob? Is it Bob guy?
Yes, it is.
The one who's like writes the poem?
Yeah.
That's Bob.
He looks exactly like that. that character has to look, and that's amazing casting.
Yeah.
It's just the minute you see him, you know his entire story. Like, he was the football guy, and now he's just nothing.
It's John Hughes casting, like I tell you. It's perfect. And the, that whole reunion, it just made me laugh. Yeah, because you recognize people you know in it. And I had read that Timothy based it on real people at his high school.
Yeah, they had to change a couple of names apparently at the last minute. if this piece of IMDb trivia is true.
Yeah.
That Piven's character was originally named for the guy that he did know.
Yes. Oh, and did you know that Piven and Cusack were acting buddies? That he went to his parents' school?
They've known each other forever.
Yeah. Wow, I did not know that.
Apparently they broke up. They're no longer friends. Sometime in the last 15 years, they have had a separation.
Oh, man.
I remember reading an interview about it once and going, aw. Sad. But and I guess the other thing that's incredible about Piven is that he does have exactly the same energy that Jeremy Piven still kind of has.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like he hasn't changed in 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's both an interesting commentary on the character that he plays and on Jeremy Piven. It's like Cusack, he's kind of been forced because he never really became the leading man that I think he wanted to be.
Really?
Within Hollywood, he's off doing these weird little action movies and these European co-pros and stuff where he can just... He's in Cell with Sam Jackson, Stephen King adaptation that is just not very good. but he's still pursuing the roles he wants to pursue. I don't get the sense, except for some of the action stuff, where he's just... I think he just wants to be in a... He wants to go to Prague for 6 weeks, and this is how he does it.
Yeah.
Like, he's financing an interesting life. He's not doing the make one for you, make one for them thing either. He's just going where the work is, but in a way that I feel like he's still chasing something, which is interesting. But Piven goes and does Entourage and becomes like deliriously typed in this thing and doesn't seem to want to leave it.
Huh.
And
I wonder how much of it is him, because I thought he was, I didn't watch a lot of Entourage because I thought he was an asshole.
Possible, or maybe he's the best asshole.
Yeah.
He's good at this. But I can also say, like, it's weird that the dynamic between the two of them in Gross Point is that Martin Blank is happy to see this guy and then almost immediately tired of him.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if that's something that's coming because of their interests, and that's why Piven's perfect in the role, because Cusack knew he could do that with him.
Oh,
it's weird. It's one of those things where gains so much meaning in retrospect, and I can never figure out if that's because I'm trying to impose meaning on it or because it was always there. This is the life of the film critic. It's like, well, this means this, probably.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it can be exhausting.
It keeps you awake at night sometimes, I bet. Yeah, something.
But then you get a movie where it is the 20th anniversary this year of the release of Gross Point Blank.
Holy
which
shit.
Makes my head melt.
Oh my God.
Oh, I know. That's the 15th anniversary Blu-ray.
That is amazing.
Here we are. But yeah, we're old now.
And there have really not been a lot of movies. I can't think of a movie like Gross Point Blank, really.
Just the mashup stuff that I was talking about. But those are different in every way. They're simply, they share a common spark, right? But it's not. Yeah, there's no way that you could put Gross Point Blank and Shaun of the... Although, well, okay, let's see. Gross Point Blank and Shaun of the Dead are both about arrested adolescence in a weird way. It's just that with Martin Blank, he's been an adult for 10 years, and now it's catching up to him that he missed his childhood. And Shaun of the Dead is the other thing. It's about somebody resisting masturbation. Yeah. but I guess both films are about the men trying to save the women they love from a world that wants them dead. I guess. It's a stretch.
It's a stretch, but it kind of, it's better than some of the other ways I've heard people describe the film.
Yeah, but what else is, you're right, what else is like Gross Point Blank? There have been movies that have tried.
Have there been action romantic comedies? I mean, I guess like True Lies, which I haven't seen.
Mrs. Smith?
Okay,
probably
there
the
you go.
Probably the only one I can think of that really works, that actually lands the goal, which creates another, it's a marvelous alternate reality where everyone is you know, sleek and perfect and beautiful. And the biggest joke of the film is that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are pretending to be normal for the first hour. Like, that's, it's a totally different metaphor, though, because it's a marriage movie.
And I haven't seen, I've worked with Doug Liman, but I've never seen Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Is it a great. Tonally, is it similar? Like, this
kind of. It has the same joy. Like, it has the same pleasure in physical action. Did you work with him?
He was my boss on Covert Affairs and Suits. And so he actually came in. One day, he likes to fly planes. He flew in and said, I'm directing second unit today. And he just did this huge boat chase. It was like, wow. Like, this, it was in season one of Covert. But on Suits, he just comes and visits. He doesn't really direct any, you know. But it reminded me of, today I read that George Armitage talked about the process of getting that tone. And he said he would always do three versions of each.
Yeah.
And that's what we do on Suits. We did on Suits. I was on it for the first four seasons, but we would do three versions. And he said the one, Armitage said the one that was always just slightly larger than life would always win, usually.
Right. So it's scripted, improv, and then what's the other?
Well, scripted, like, there's also, like, on Suits, it's more like the serious version, the playful version, okay. And the, I don't know. Like, there's always, it'll always be three different things, but, he basically shot three movies simultaneously. One that stuck to the script, one that was mildly understated, right? And one that went completely over the top. And the over the top would win.
Okay. But that works for Gross Point Blank because the reality is already heightened and insane.
Yeah.
It's just, it is crazy. I'm looking at the cover now in this weird, soft Photoshop picture of John Cusack looking adorably at the camera and Minnie Driver looking adorably at John Cusack. And it's like, that is not this movie. I mean, she hates him for the first half. He ruined her teenagehood. He destroyed so much of her. And then when he returns, he's there to kill her dad.
Yes, but he doesn't know that.
Right. But it is, again, it has to be, right? Like, there's no question that that's what's going on because this is that kind of movie. The smart structure of it. That when he sees the packet and just finally opens it, which he's been putting off the entire film, we don't even see it. We just know. Dumb fucking luck.
And, like, you do have to suspend your disbelief. That's the one thing that you go, okay, like, how, yeah, dumb luck. But then at the same time, he does make you believe that he doesn't really want to do this, you know, whoever this kill is, he's really there for his reunion. And then, oh, shit.
Yeah. But it also gives him the magnificent excuse to get out of it.
Yeah.
Because if it's anybody else, he would probably have an easier time following through,
yeah.
Even with the existential crisis. But then, of course, you have the classic, well, the now classic. I was trying to figure it out. There must have been other movies about elite fraternities of assassins where, you know, if you give up, you become the target. And now we're all just like, well, it's part of John Wick Chapter 2. It's everywhere. It's part of the language. It's the thing you do when you play spy. It's like, well, if it's, you know, Mr. Bond, it's time. If you haven't fulfilled this, we're going to send 008 after you.
Yeah.
And this film executes that in such a great, almost, I don't even know, depressingly resigned way. Everybody's really just pissed off and sad and tired. It's great. It's
cynicism is so good.
It's that early thing where, you know, why do you always have to say you met the guy? Why do you always have to be the person who met the guy?
Yeah.
There's an idiosyncrasy to it that says that this could be happening instead of the perfect world of Mr. and Mrs. Smith or the killer where people walk around with, I assume, 9,000 bullet reservoirs on their backs because that way they never have to reload. There's no fantastical aspect of it beyond the fact that this thing is happening. Everybody relates to it in a real way, which makes it funny and real and earthy and grounded, I guess is the word I'm looking for, in a way that, oh, also someone is being killed with a microwave.
Right. And it didn't hit me the first time, but the union, like, that line about loner, lone gunman, get it? I didn't get into this business to get into relationships. It's the perfect, like, B story. It's the perfect.
Yeah. And it gives Ackroyd's character a motivation that is, like, it's not nefarious. He's open about it.
He really wants to start a union.
Yeah. And that would lead us to, like, I mean, it would be so great if in an alternate universe, Gross Point Blank gave us the John Wick world of, you know, like, where there's, have you seen the John Wick films?
I haven't. I know people who worked on them and they sound amazing. They sound actually like,
they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And they're psychotically detailed. The first movie introduces you to this hotel in New York City where all the assassins can go because it's sacred ground. You can show up and your mortal enemy can be there and you have to have a drink. And you can't fall. And then the sequel just says, oh yeah, it's global. It's everywhere. There's this wonderful moment. And again, it feels like a Gross Point Blank moment where Wick shows up in Rome to do...
Yeah, they shot a whole sequence in Rome with Ruby Rose, apparently, because I worked with her right after that.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
He shows up in Rome and goes to the other Continental, the other hotel, the equivalent in Rome. And it's Franco Nero is running it, because of course he is. And he says, I only have one question for you. You're not here for the Pope, are you? No. Okay, then. And then whatever else is fine. And that's the same kind of mentality. It's there. It's the unspoken thing that's in Pulp Fiction, too, where bad guys are bad guys, but they also have codes and lives. Yeah. And I think that's what I love about Gross Point Blank, is that it finally found a way, for the first time, really, because Pulp Fiction is still so stylized, it found a way to make you believe that this thing is real. And that this spectacular violence is invading people's lives, like the convenience store thing.
Oh, that's insanity. Genius.
But it's so great.
You can't go home again, but I guess you can shop there. Yeah. That's my other favorite quote.
Yeah. And then you destroy it. And ultimately, his home is destroyed twice.
Oh, we did an homage. We stole that scene on Suits where... he goes to visit his dad's grave and he pours the whiskey. Mm. You'll see that on Suits, Harvey. Oh, yeah. And I don't know if that... I mean, we often paid homage. Like, they would often reference 80s and 90s direct quotes or plot lines even. But that was, like, verbatim. Did they do that in any other movie?
I'm sure there's a bunch of... Subsequently, though, I think, like, I'm trying to picture it if I'd ever seen it before.
Yeah, it's like I hadn't seen it before, but...
No, the idea of pouring one out isn't new.
Yeah.
The framing in the shot.
Yeah. Pouring it out over the grave of your... Then it tells the whole story without a single word, right? Like, that was the beauty of that. It's funny how fast they dealt with his father and mother. Like,
one scene,
boom.
Yeah, because you can't dwell, right? Like, if you ask too many questions, it falls apart. What do you mean you had a certain moral flexibility? I would love to see the recruitment scene, but I don't need to.
Right.
Like, the way he relates it to someone while he's trying to take this, like, he's trying to smooth it down and take the edges off of it and make it sound reasonable is infinitely funnier than anything, and sadder, too, because he doesn't really have the facility to connect with his emotions and talk about what that meant. It's great. It is. It's just, it is a perfect combination of script and character and actor. It's one of those things where I like High Fidelity, but I really I regret that he doesn't take a moment and go out and shoot somebody just in the middle of a scene. Sorry, I have to take this call, kind of thing. It could have happened.
He doesn't get to kickbox either in High Fidelity, does he?
No, I don't think so.
Does he take Tim Robbins down? I can't remember. I just remember he calls him a patchouli wearing motherfucker or something.
Yeah, I think it's been a while since I've seen High Fidelity, but I think Robbins gets the better of him, doesn't he? Like, doesn't he?
Oh God, I don't know. It's been a while. I just remember the patchouli. Yeah.
Well, people, tell us on Twitter.
Yeah.
Tim Robbins is out there. You're welcome to come on the show and defend yourself. Just, you know, with words. But yeah, it is. Oh, it's. I just love this movie so much. I'm so glad you picked it. It's such a great choice. And, you know, we've known each other 30 years. So it's insane that a film like this can resonate in so many different directions or just be enjoyed as a simple action movie.
Yeah.
Because it still can. And, anything that gets it back, it gets it back into circulation.
I was shocked about the box office. It only, according to IMDb...
tanked.
Well, no. I mean, it made twice its money back, but $28 million is not a lot.
Not good. No, 97, too. It should have been... 97 was the year of, like, dueling... Wasn't it Volcano Movie Year? Or was that...
Well, they said it was High School Reunion Year. Like, I had forgotten, but Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion came out 2 weeks later.
That fast? I knew they were the same year. Jesus.
But I remember enjoying that movie, but I don't remember that movie.
It's pretty good. I have to say, it is pretty good. It is. There's a Blu-ray of it around here somewhere.
You have everything. This is an amazing layout.
I am. Well, this is what happens when OCD combines with, there it is.
When OCD with your job.
Combines with life opportunities.
Yeah.
There, also 15th anniversary edition. Oh, that amazing. Can't be right. That would have been 2000 and... Oh, no, 2012. Yeah, sure, we had Blu-ray in 2012. That makes sense.
And this does pass the Bechdel test, of course.
I'm pretty sure it does.
Yeah, it must.
No, it's Remy Michelle. I knew they were released... Was it 2 weeks apart?
Well, I read that. I read that in someone's blog.
One was spring and one was fall, but you could be like, that may be right.
I mean, that's a crazy choice. I guess, and they were saying it's the year of the run of the high school reunion movies. I don't remember any other high school reunion. No,
those were the only ones I can think of. And the other thing that's so weird is that Con Air was like a year before that.
Oh, really?
Like, it was right around the same time. It followed The Rock, so it would have been 96. It might have been the same year, actually.
Oh, wow.
That Blu-ray is up there somewhere, too, but it's too high to reach. Yeah, it's just that moment where you see Cusack trying to figure out what to do in a weird way and having control for that mm-hmm. little window of time with Con Air and with Grosse Pointe and with High Fidelity. There was a moment where he really could have done anything and he made the movies he wanted to make. And it still bothers me that they weren't bigger hits. Like, it should have been... Okay, Con Air was. But that wasn't Cusack. It should have been... He should still be able to write his own ticket. I mean...
Yes.
It just...
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, as I retire out of script supervision, I'm like, will I ever get the chance to work with this guy? That's like... That is one person I would have loved.
Maybe you need to write something for him.
Oh, God. Because he's a great writer, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he can rewrite it.
I don't think he's writing a lot of stuff these days. That's the other one that's... I don't want to let the episode go without mentioning War Incorporated, which was his kind of sequel, which is...
I just read about that and I'd never heard of it. Yeah. So, like, was it the same characters? Or
no. Okay. No, he's... Other than dressing the same, which is kind of his thing anyway.
Yeah.
No, but,
Cause I just read about that this morning and I was like, what? War Incorporated? Where was I in 2008? That I don't remember this.
It came out. It is not memorable. No, it's really bad. It's a very sour, almost reactionary liberal pushback against the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. And while it comes from a real place of disappointment and anger, it also is kind of insufferably smarmy about its inherent rightness.
I had read an interview with him where he said Grosse Pointe Blank was his comment on the American dream in the way that the Reagan era, you know, the way it was in the Reagan era. And
you can see that.
You can see that, but it's subtle. It's more, I mean, you know, it's actually not subtle, but it's not overt either. It's there
for a character who would have grown up in the Hughes movies.
Yeah,
like that's how I think that's what we're saying, is that he was extrapolating that you go off and you're immediately disillusioned and you end up spending 10 years just doing horrible, horrible things in the name of progress. That I totally get. So it's, yes, War Incorporated. He played a character named Hauser.
Okay.
He is effectively Martin Blank after a bad relationship. I think we're supposed to believe that
him and Minnie broke up.
It didn't work out, and now he's back to the thing, and he's there. He's sent to the Middle East to kill a minister who's standing in the way of progress or something. But there's also this thing with Hilary Duff as a pop star, and Dan Aykroyd plays the vice president. And,
oh, wow.
I mean, it's not obviously not the same character, but he's sort of still the cynical authority figure, mentor.
Super smart language kind of thing.
Well, less so, because he's much more brusque, I remember, in the movie. I mean, this is something I haven't seen in 10 years. But, yeah, it's not good. And Marissa Tomei is in it as the woman who sort of awakens him again to the possibility of doing good. But it's such a grind. It's just no fun at all. And it's all about the tone, right? Like, it just doesn't... It goes so wide. And it's so pissy about its liberalism.
So it is intended to be a comedy, but it doesn't have joy.
It wants to be. Yeah. It is like a weak echo of Grosse Pointe Blank, and maybe that's why Cusack doesn't do stuff he cares about anymore, because this was his thing and it just didn't fly.
Huh.
But it also arrived at exactly the wrong time. It was the spring, I want to say, of 2008, and Obama was ramping up and the world was changing and Bush fatigue had already, Stone's W was out at the same time, and it was all it was too much. There was no good political satire right then.
Okay. Because
everything was like, boy, everything's cynical and corporate, and George Bush is a dummy. And it's like, yes, that's all true, but I knew that when I sat down. And then watching Cusack go through the motions on this was just really really sad.
Oh, who directed it?
I think Joshua Guy. I've never
Let's blame the director.
It's easy.
Poor director.
Yeah, Joshua Seftel, who made... he was a producer of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, apparently. And that is the IMDb telling me that he didn't do anything else. He has 24 directorial credits.
Really?
Yeah. TV? Oh, a lot of television.
Yeah.
Short films.
Any good television?
Nothing I recognize. He did a documentary about Annie. It's the Hard Knock Life from Script to Stage.
Huh.
An insider's look at the Tony-nominated revival of the musical Annie. And a bunch of Nova Science Now. So yeah, no, this was his only feature as far as I can tell. And it was not good. So that's good, I guess. Self-selection. But best not to bother with it and to just focus on the original as a singular piece of entertainment. That is truly, like, I'm going to argue for it as Cusack's finest hour. It is so goddamn great. Yeah. So the final question on the podcast is always the same as well, which is, what of Gross Point Blank have you borrowed or stolen or lifted or incorporated into your creative DNA?
That is a great question. You know, the spirit, I would say the spirit of it. I work really, really hard always to add a surprise to every scene. And, you know, it's funny. It's like no one ever told me to do that, but Gross Point Blank has stayed with me in that sense. It's like, okay, what is the opposite of what we would expect to happen? And also in the way I use words, I aspire to write a script with that kind of language. I mean, I believe that I'm going in that direction, but it is obviously, I consider it a masterpiece of dialogue writing, of comedic dialogue writing. So I don't believe I'm there yet, but I aspire to have a surprise turn in every scene and to use language that is outside of the norm. Very early on in high school, one of my English teachers read a statistic about the number of words in the English language that was used on Three's Company versus Cheers and Frasier. And it's because of the intellectual characters in Frasier that it was a difference between 397 and 800 words in the English language. Now, if you think about Gross Point, I know it's surprising, right? It's surprising because you'd think there's more words than that. But no, the writers, they literally analyze the words. So if you look at Gross Point Blank, there's words in there you don't see in almost any other. So you can imagine it's probably over 1,000, right?
And it is. There's so much pleasure taken in the language. The characters, the characters are smart and the actors are enjoying it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh God, if you're not having, by the way, I as a crew member, as a lowly crew member, will, ever since Greek Wedding, and which was 1999, I will always choose a movie based on the script. Now you will see maybe a couple of exceptions to that on my resume where you're like, well, then why did you do Triple X? It was 100% fun, by the way. But if you have to find the joy, and for me, the joy starts with the script. If you can see the potential, for joy in the making of it.
Well, that's good. So what is the most joyful experience you've ever had?
Oh, as a crew member?
Yeah.
As a crew member, I would say, well, Greek Wedding, certainly, because we had to shoot that in 30 days. We had 10 actors. I can't remember the number. We had an insanely large amount of cast in every scene, and we laughed every day. We never went overtime. I know it was very, you know, it was accused of being shot very pedestrian, but that was a TV director. I thought he did an amazing job. He just did something that was a really hard thing to achieve in 30 days and pulled it together. And I would say the other one would be Boondock Saints.
Okay.
When I got the job, the director said, have you seen Overnight, by the way?
Yes.
Okay.
He's finest hour.
He is not that crazy. Like, he is actually very good to work with. No, I'm being serious. That's why they could hardly show any footage from set, because on set he was actually fine as a director. It's afterwards that he potentially snapped, if anything. But anyway, Troy said to me in the interview, what did you think of my script? And I said, I laughed really hard. It's really funny. And he said, you're hired. Everyone else told me they were offended by my script. So I don't know. I just got it. But then, like, that was the first time I got to work with so many comedians, like so many. It was very fun.
Yeah, the energy is, I mean, again, it's all about what everybody can do together, right? Like, it's the collective energy of the thing, which is why I'm sure, like, the people on Gross Point are just having the best time.
I hope so, anyway. I know that Woody Allen sets are very serious. Like, that's what I've worked with some of his crews, and they're like, he's really super serious. You're not allowed to laugh. And if you laugh on set, you're not. They're not going to laugh on screen, kind of thing. But I don't believe
that's
that.
That's not a thing.
I don't believe that. No.
I mean, maybe with Bedtime Story, like that famously terrible Marlon Brando, David Niven movie.
Oh,
I didn't... It's the film that was remade as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh, okay.
And the story goes that there are a handful of takes because, like, the film... Bedtime Story has this weird stiffness to it, and it's because they cut every time they had to cut away from people breaking up. People laughed constantly on the set, but you watch it, and it's this dead thing. It's not funny at all.
Oh.
And then you see Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and it's the same script. Some minor variations, and they change the nature of the Glenn Headley character. But the relationship, like, there are entire scenes that are identical,
and
they're hysterical. Because Kane and Martin are just having... They're incorporating that pleasure. They're not trying to stay straight. Like, they're...
Oh, yeah.
They smile. They sneer. They're doing stuff. And Gross Point has the same kind of energy to me. It's the fact that Aykroyd and Cusack genuinely enjoy their scenes together, even though Cusack hates him. Like, there's this sort of weary tolerance for him. Because they're just... These are nice people to talk to. And yeah,
they're equally matched in terms of wits and ability. They're just, it's so funny.
Yeah. A couple of Chicago guys. Just
Yeah, really.
Yeah. So, okay. So go do that as a screener.
Okay. Yeah. I could do it. No problem. I'm also from the class of 86. I could do this.
There you go.
My thanks to Daniela Scioni, who's currently developing a screenplay, the WBI, with her co-writer, Annie Bradley, and prepping for work on another great big movie project we'll be hearing about pretty soon. You can find Daniela on Twitter at HellaciousD, D-E-E, all one word, and you can find Gross Point Blank on DVD and Blu-ray from Walt Disney Studios Home Entertainment. It's also available for sale and rental on iTunes and Google Play, and streaming on Netflix Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. Maybe you could say something awesome about how I killed the president of Paraguay with a fork. Thanks for listening.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.